My next guest, you're going to love. His name is David Sears. David served 20 years of active military duty within the United States Special Operations Command as a U.S. Navy SEAL officer. Commander Sears served on multiple East Coast SEAL teams, Naval Special Warfare Development Group, Joint Commands, and many, many other assignments within the teams. And after a decorated military career, David and a business partner created Zundis Global. Zundis is a niche transdisciplinary consultancy that leads clients to see the world differently and align organizational culture, structure, processes, and resources to achieve favorable outcomes in a dynamic and turbulent world. Next on the CJ Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here. Thank you for tuning in. I know you got many choices, but thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. Big shout out to all those brave men and women serving, protecting this great country every day, whether you're in the military, whether you're a first responder, whatever you're doing in criminal justice. Thank you for what you do. You have much support. You know, there are so many threats out there for our brave men and women who protect this country every day, from drugs to explosives. That's where Detecticam can help your organization by offering mobile threat detection that fits in the palm of your hand. If you head over to the website, cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to Detecticam. See how they can help you protect your personnel. You know, folks, we all face roadblocks, obstacles in our life, and we all need help and guidance beyond those roadblocks and obstacles. Frame of Mind Coaching can help you. If you head over to the website, you're going to see a free assessment link. Click on it, take it, see what Frame of Mind Coaching can do for you. On to the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I'm very excited to have my next guest on the show, David Sears. He's a former commander serving 20 years of active duty service with the United States Special Operations Command as a U.S. Navy SEAL officer. Sir, welcome, David.
Hey, thanks, Patrick.
Appreciate you being here. Did I miss anything in that bio? I know you've done so much more within the teams. Did I miss anything? Anything you want to add?
No, we always like to, you know, we like to glaze over it. And so That was 20 years. Had a whole bunch of experiences, and that's good.
Now, what made you, I mean, I ask a lot of military, I ask the same with law enforcement when they're on. What made you join the service, the Navy?
I'd love to give you, like, this really cool, good story. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, I had this passion as a child and all I want. But the truth is, I wanted to serve. I was always interested in service. I had applied to the academies and things like that. And it was an interest in service. But it was also at the same time a financial interest. How am I going to pay for school? So I got an ROTC scholarship. That was one of the ways I actually got accepted to the Naval Academy on an alternate basis. And most alternates make it. They flew me out there for a visit. And I knew within about a couple of minutes, like, no way can I do this. This is way too military for me. Like, I can't tromp around in uniform. And no way am I doing this. So I went the ROTC route. And doing that, I grew up junior high and high school in Colorado, and I was outdoorsy, loved running around, always was into special forces kind of things and kind of enamored with that and spy novels and whatnot, and very physical. So I had, you know, scuba diving experience already and had an affinity towards that. And halfway through college, my roommate, his stepbrother was a Navy SEAL who had just gotten out and was going to Harvard Med. And we went out and partied, and he's like, why the hell aren't you going into the SEAL teams? And I said, well, I don't have 20/20 vision. I had made this stupid assumption that you need 20/20 vision or you're disqualified. I figured SEALs are perfect, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, you don't need that. What's your vision? And I was like, oh, it's 20/40, 20/70. And he's like, that's it. That's the qualifying. You're good. And then that was it. Then I went down the track and realized that I was able to do it, you know, per their qualifications. And then I just set out from there. It was kind of, I've always been very independent. I wanted a place that was creative. I didn't want to be part of the mob. I wanted to be, you know, be someone special kind of thing. And it seemed to be a natural fit. And then the intent was go in, do my 4-year payback for the scholarship, and then get out and go to the next phase of life. Yeah. And it went longer than that.
Just a little bit. Well, thank you for your service, David. And was there ever a time, I know you probably got this question before, was there ever a time at the beginning of your SEAL training that you said, you know what, screw this shit, I'm not doing this stuff? Or was it always just motoring through and the mindset and, you know?
No, it was always motoring through. I don't think that you can make it through if you have any attitude other than, I'm going to succeed at this. You have to go in with the mindset. And I'll tell people that they'll ask, hey, what advice? My son's going to BUDS, which is the initial SEAL training, kind of the first vetting period, mm-hmm. more of a self-selection sort of piece. You know, they want you to make it through, but they also want to weed out people. But they, you know, you kind of deselect yourself by quitting or getting hurt or not performing to some extent, but it's mostly, you know, deselection of you quitting. And people say, hey, what advice, you know, do you have? And I'm like, there's only one thing, you know, you just can't ever quit. It's super easy advice, but very difficult to execute. So it's just that mindset of, once you have it in your head, I am not going to quit, and you truly believe that, and they'll have to kill me to get me out of here, then you make it through, and it's not that big a deal. It's really not that hard. But people crack, or they start letting those ideas creep in. Well, screw this. I'm not going to do it anymore. Or I have family. I mean, I've heard all the excuses. Mm-hmm. And it's, you got to have that mindset going in. And if you have that, you'll make it through.
Because the attrition rates are through the roof. I mean, they're, what are they? I mean,
crazy. They're usually, I think they average around 80% attrition or somewhere in there.
But then if you get, I'm sure there were people that get hurt and they just recycle them through, or the next class, yeah. or what?
If you're a good guy and, you know, they like the way you're performing and your attitude, and you get hurt, they will recycle. So there's three phases. First phase is called strength and conditioning, and that's where you hear the famous hell week. Then you have second phase, which is diving, mm-hmm. combat diving. And then you have third phase, which is land warfare. So they're all about 2 months or so. So 6 months in total, something like that. And if you, let's say you're in second phase and you fail one of the events, and they recycle you, or you step in a pothole and break your ankle, they will recycle you to the beginning of that phase that you were in, mm-hmm. and then until you're healthy. Now, certain injuries, they're like, hey, you're never going to recover. But probably when I was in, it was more, you saw a lot of stress fractures. That was probably the most common injury to get recycled. You would have guys just, you know, we weren't super bright back then. So you were still running in boots in the sand and the concrete and stuff like that. And it just takes its toll on your shins and your lower leg, and that you get a lot of stress. That was probably the most common thing, is stress fractures in, you know, the tib fib. And they would recycle a guy. If he was a good guy, they'd say, okay, hey, heal up, get yourself better. And then we recycle to another class or whatever. Making it straight through is there. It's even a higher attrition rate. So, I mean, personally, I went straight through. I didn't want to spend any more time there than I had to,
sure.
although you know, I wasn't going to quit, but hey, let's just get this done. Don't need to be here for a year or whatever. But I think my class, I don't remember the exact numbers, but we probably fourth phase, which they used to have this thing called fourth phase, which is a preliminary phase. So whenever you show up, you have kind of a 2 month window to show up before your class starts actually. And they do some physical training in that and start to get you used to it. So we were about 180 something in that at its peak. And then I think we classed up with first phase somewhere maybe in the 130s or 140s. Mm-hmm. I think about 20 or 22 of us went straight through. And then we graduated with somewhere around, I don't know, somewhere in the 30s, 30, 33, 34, something like that. Because the guys that rolled into our class.
Sure. And then you get done, and then you get assigned to, you know, one of the teams, right?
Yeah, it's all changed now. It's mm-hmm. they revamped the system. So the way it worked when I was doing it is you would then head off to Static Line Jump School in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Sure.
You would go there and get your static line qualification, which is, you know, people are listening. It's just essentially your parachute has a rope attached to it or a line attached to it that hooks onto the airplane. So when you jump out, it automatically pulls it for you. It's this big, round, non-maneuverable chute. You call it dope on a rope.
I remember it well. I was in the 82nd, so.
There you go. Anybody can do it, right?
Yeah, just drop them. Just give them your static line to Jumpmaster and just fall out.
Yeah, that's basically it, right? And after that, you get assigned to a team. You go to your team then, and then you go through what was called SEAL tactical training. So another 3 to 4 months of advanced training. Then you get assigned to a platoon. And then you get your trident. Once you've done a probationary period, you get your trident, and they, you know, that's our badge, our specialty warfare badge, and you're called a SEAL for real then. Now, they've changed it a bit. You go right after the BUDS training, you graduate that, and you go to what's called SEAL qualification training, SQT. And that's about 3 months or so, I think. And that includes in it, we're running our own static line course now, our own free fall course. They get all those qualifications. They do the advanced training. At the end of that, they get their trident, and then they get assigned to it, and then they go to a team. Mm-hmm. So they come to a team now with their trident. It's, you know, it's potato, potato, I guess.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit, if you don't mind, and talk about, I know you've been on Fox News recently, and you were talking about, you know, various threats, North Korea and other threats to the United States. You've been all over, decorated vet. You know, you've been in more than 40 countries, 5 continents, you know, Afghanistan, Colombia. What do you think the biggest threats are out there? Maybe that's too broad of a question, David, but I'll ask it anyway. What or who are the biggest threats facing the U.S. today?
I think one of the biggest threats that we kind of stick our heads in the sand about is a lot of this cyber stuff. Mm. Our whole system is set up around the old sort of Westphalian idea of nation states. And you see in the military, you see, you know, Department of State, whatever, the intelligence agencies, they have geographic responsibilities or country responsibilities. Well, the threats aren't always coming from countries anymore, or they're crossing boundaries. So who's responsible for, you know, a cyber attack from Russia or China? And I think that some of the cyber stuff, the damage that it can do is really unbelievable. You know, you can, whatever, you can set off, you know, if they can shut off a city's, you know, water filtration system, you know, you've got these cities now, 7 to 10 million people, or even mega cities, that if you cut off their water, or you can
chaos,
you
know,
complete chaos, right? So those are huge. That's a huge threat, and I think that a lot of people are ill-equipped to handle it. We're working on it, but we're behind. And because of our connection to technology and how interconnected we are, we're a lot more vulnerable than some of these other countries. You know, if you shut off Russia's stuff, okay, I mean, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, we have food lines and blackouts anyway.
Yes. Yeah, they're used to it.
Or you've got, you know, a couple billion people in China, they're going to be like, what, we're out without electricity? Oh, we already don't have electricity, half of us, so whatever, right? But they could really damage our society. So I think that that's a huge threat. I think that you also have the idea, I used to go a little bit outside of the box and say, you know, I think that our debt is a big threat, you know, that gets kicked down the road, and we keep compiling this, and it's going to have, eventually the bill's going to come due. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hey, how, but the nature of our politics and the way we work is very short-sighted. You know, we work in these really compressed election cycles, and looking out strategically like that is not one of our fortes. You know, the physical threats that are out there, North Korea is always an issue. Anybody with nukes is an issue, and the proliferation of nuclear weapons is an issue. that you have to be careful of. You know, the more they proliferate, the more the chances go up of one falling into the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. So that's always an issue. But I personally think that, you know, something like the cyber piece is a way bigger threat than, and can damage, you know, society way more than even a nuke going off in the middle of a town can. So that's going to have physical damage and, you know, psychological damage. But if you, like we talked about, you know, you cut off the water supply, or you taint the water supply, or you, you know, shut down the markets on Wall Street, holy crap. You know, if nobody can get to the ATMs, you know, or imagine you could set off, like, turn off GPS signals. So if you can interrupt that, everything that we have now runs on clocks that are set from space, essentially, in the GPS satellite system. Mm-hmm. So if you can turn off all our clocks, your ATMs don't work anymore, your phone's not going to work, your computers are going to be not working. I mean, all these things are dependent upon precise timekeeping. That would be catastrophically damaging.
One thing, and you were talking about it when I saw you on Fox a while ago, and you were talking, you mentioned it, about the grid system and where it's held together. It's so antiquated. That's the thing that scares the hell out of me, among all the things that we just talked about. But our grid system, we need to start doing more and spending more with our infrastructure, because, like you said, it's held together with duct tape and paper clips. I think you were the one that said that on Fox News. I may be wrong, but that's some scary shit, Dave.
It is some scary stuff. And you have the way that it's not antiquated enough where you – so you have some places, some countries have such an antiquated system that we really have a hard time doing anything against it in the cyber realm, because mm-hmm. – it's not connected in the right ways. You know, they still have, you know, transistors and junk that you're like, holy cow, this is so antiquated phone system that you can't get to. Ours is right in the middle there, where it's extremely vulnerable and doesn't have the gateways in, and it really does need to be updated. But again, that's one of those strategic problems that, and it's hard to visually see. So people blow it off and it goes, you know, it gets kicked down the road.
Yeah.
It's these abstract ideas that we have a tough time with. And the cyber world and the idea of the grid system is an abstract idea.
Let's shift gears again and talk about what you're doing with your company, Zundis Global. Doing a lot of great things.
Yeah, we just got done doing, so we run workshops based on this thing called crisp thinking. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is, how do you deal with complex problems? So first you have to buy into the notion that we are in a complex world, and that we are changing. The world is changing at a much greater rate than it has in the past. You know, we saw leaps of innovation, and big leaps would happen, you know, every 100 years, then every 50 years. Now we're to every 10 years. 5 years, every year. So change is happening at a much greater rate. The pace of change has increased, and it's made the world incredibly complex. And the tools that we have to deal with that are limited, and they're not being taught. We have tools to deal with a slow changing world in a linear fashion. Mm-hmm. That's how we're taught in school. We're taught to solve complicated problems, not complex problems. Because complex problems, so let me give you an example. Complicated is, simplest example would be a car. So it's a complicated system, but with the right amount of expertise and knowledge, you can take that whole thing apart into all its parts and pieces and put it back together. I can't anymore, but the right can now. My engine's like sideways and upside down. I used to sit in my Bronco, and I could actually work on it sitting on the, you know, in it with my legs in the Bronco.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, where the hell is the, what? This engine's like upside down. And
it's just a computer. It's a computer now.
Yeah, exactly. So, but that's a complicated problem, right? That can be solved. Us going to the moon, when Kennedy said, hey, we're going to go to the moon, that was actually a complicated problem. Mm-hmm. We didn't know the math yet, but we knew that it was physically possible. And so with the right amount of expertise and effort and resources poured towards this, you can solve it. And we did. A complex problem would be, taking the car example again, put a person in that car and put them on the highway system and try to tell me what's going to happen. There's no way. Mm-hmm. You know, classic complex problems that are examples would be terrorism, crime, poverty. You cannot, there is no solution. And that's the mistake that we're making, is that there's a solution. And so we apply what we call solutions to these things, and we only make them worse, or we're at best, you know, acting randomly. So what we're trying to do is give people some tools to navigate complexity. You can't control it. There is no single solution. What you can do is you try and kind of be like a sailor and navigate, you know, with the weather and the best possible approach that you can find, and then sense and see what happens, and then navigate and adjust course. So that's what we're trying to do with that. It's about getting back to, you know, CRISP is an acronym, and we don't care if people memorize the acronym. It doesn't really matter. What matters is they internalize the concept of you need a different way of thinking. So we keep harping on the idea that the same thinking is going to get you the same results. So you have to change the way you think about problems. And so we preach on, you know, critical thinking and creative thinking and the mix of that. We talk about the R is reflective reframing. You know, how do you frame a problem? How do you reframe a problem and look at it from multiple angles? Mm-hmm. You know, as a cop and a former military guy, you know, like, you try and gather as many perspectives and angles as you can on, say, a physical structure or a target that you have to go take down.
Sure.
You don't just look at the front door and go, okay, we're good.
Yeah.
Try and get, you know, reconnaissance around it from multiple sides. And you got to do that in the abstract world too. Look at it from multiple angles, from multiple perspectives, to gain the greatest possible picture you can. And then you reflect on your thinking. You know, this is where true learning occurs. It doesn't occur while you're actually participating in some activity of learning activity or doing something. It's the reflection upon that activity or what you did that's when the learning occurs. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's the hot washes that happen after you go take down a target, or it's the discussion of what did we do? What did I learn there? And learning is a social activity as well. So it needs to be done by multiple people. Then we talk about ideation. How do you, you know, do brainstorming and come up with new ideas for good approaches? And then we preach systemic synthesis is the S. And that's talking about, we really like, in the complex world, systems is a huge piece. It's a complex adaptive system. So the better that you can appreciate that system and map it and know where you are in it, you're never going to know all the pieces. We equate it to, do you remember Don Rumsfeld saying, he was giving a speech once, and he was talking about the known knowns, the unknown knowns.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And they ripped him apart for it. He's actually a pretty brilliant guy. That completely describes complexity. There's going to be unknown unknowns. So you want to map the system as much as you can. And then you know that you're going to have unknowns in there. So we teach some systems thinking tools, and then you want to synthesize things. So what we're taught, this linear thinking methodology, is the primary thing is analysis. And analysis is reductionist thinking that breaks things down into parts. And we're very good at siloing things, but that's not how complex systems work. Mm-hmm. You can't mess with one part and then put that back in the system and expect that it's going to be fixed. So we want you to synthesize ideas and systems and approaches all together to come to the best, you know, approach you can have. It's like being called into a company. You know, I came into some company to help them with the sales, their sales forces. They're like, our sales are down, and, you know, we want you to take a look at the sales department. Like, yeah. Okay, but it goes along the methodology of the you know, the shin bones connected to the knee bones connected to the hip bone.
Everything's right? connected. Yeah.
What are you doing for branding? What are you doing for marketing? Hey, who's your HR hiring to come in here? All these pieces, your problem may not be in your sales department. Mm-hmm. It could be deriving from somewhere else, but you got to get deeper into it and figure out how all these things are connected. The interesting thing in systems is not the nodes or the actors in the system, it's the relationships between those. So that's what we want people to look at. And then we talk about possible futures is the P. And it's, we want, there's a great book, I like this guy, Nassim Taleb. Mm-hmm. And he really talks in The Black Swan, and then another, you know, even better one that he has is Anti-Fragile. But he talks about looking at the possibilities, not the probabilities. Probabilities are based on past events. So it's statistics based on some things that have happened in the past. Will they happen in the future? So we end up being surprised all the time when something that's never happened in the past happens, because what's the probability of that? Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have data to tell us. So we want people to look at the possibilities out there and prepare for those, best and worst, and say, okay, what are the possibilities that have high impact on me? You know, it could be very low probability things with a high impact, and that's kind of the point of his Black Swan piece. And you prepare for those, and you consider those intellectually so that you're not surprised. And then we go into a piece to talk about, you know, storytelling. You have to be able to tell your narrative, and we talk a lot about visual learning mm-hmm. and visual representation, the use of metaphors, all that stuff. And it's really just to get people to think differently than they have been thinking and understand the nature of complexity, and that they live in a complex world. You need different tools to confront this. So it's been great. I mean, it's been great. We've been doing it for about 3 years mm-hmm. and I don't know, we've done maybe 30 or so workshops. We do like open workshops where we allow anybody to come. We had a CEO of some education software group. We had a CEO of a flatware company. We have, it's really popular in the government end because that's sort of where we came from. So we've had a lot of law enforcement come. We worked a lot with some sheriff's departments down in Florida who are trying to do some pretty innovative things. You know, this sheriff down in Florida, he initially jumped on the idea years ago of the intelligence-based policing. And he started sending guys to our workshops, and he was sending, you know, detectives at first, and then he started sending all sorts of others. He had his forensics people coming. He had some of the, we had people from prison system come. Mm-hmm. We had child, what is it? The Child Services Division. Sure. They started coming. We've had U.S. Marshals there. Guy was working anti-gang. We've had ICE there, CBP guys. We've had firefighters come. We had big success with a lot of fire departments. And they're like, how the hell does this apply to us?
It applies to everybody.
It applies to everybody. And they ended up loving it. Yeah. I mean, crushing it. And how you frame things. Huge success down there with the fire department in Pasco County. And I mean, they ended up using a lot of our things to get a lot more money, and how they presented their arguments and how they framed it to the lawmakers to get them they put up another bond in order to fund a whole bunch of other trucks and stuff. It was great for them.
Yeah.
But it's all, and it's agnostic to the domain. It's thinking. That's all it is.
Yeah. I know you guys talk a lot about, you know, do a lot of speaking, obviously, David. You talk about Trident fundamentals, maxims. Can we talk a little bit, really quick, about leadership development? You know, and I think, and you tell me from this is my opinion, I think there's a leadership void out there, both in private and you know, governments. You know, I think there's a lot of leaders out there, but I think there's a void.
I totally agree with you. There's a huge void because if you go search whatever Amazon and look for leadership books, or just search the internet and type in leadership, you're gonna get like, it's a abstract idea. It's a complex, leadership is a complex problem. And everybody's looking for a solution. And there is no one solution. There's no linear step one, step two, step three. And that's what people want. They want that certainty of, if I do A, B, and C, then I'll be a good leader. That's not the way it works. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at it from the perspective of, this is a complex problem. Leadership is, I'm a big believer in situational leadership. You have to change leadership styles, depending on what situation you're in. And it's very difficult to convince organizations. They pay leadership lip service, but they don't engage in the education of it. And what's behind leadership is the ability to think and the ability to make decisions and make the best possible decisions that you can. And they don't put the effort into teaching it or fostering it. That's what I feel like is there's this, do we check a box and we pay it lip service, but it's very difficult for companies, for organizations to see this, the ROI, the return on investment in educating their people on leadership on their, you know, financial statement. Mm-hmm. It's an abstract piece that is huge that underpins all of it, but there's no line item on your 10K or whatever that says, hey, here's what I got back. You know, we saved or made $10 million from our leadership. But yet you see all the CEOs, they'll list it as one of the top problems that they have is leadership and thinking ability. But what they do doesn't align with the problem. They're not, I think you're right. There's a void in it and it gets lip service, but it never really gets addressed because it's a complex problem. It's very hard and it's tough to get a hold of. So they apply the linear idea to it of, yeah, well, I don't know, whatever. I'll hire McKinsey to come in and teach a leadership seminar and now my guys are good. No. At best you're teaching management. Right.
And there's a big difference, in my opinion, there's a big difference between leadership and management. The other thing is that, you know, you were talking about lip service. I totally agree. It doesn't. Yeah, you can. I can read a book on leadership, but are my actions going to reflect what I just read? You know, I mean, this is the one thing I loved about the military, and you learned it in the teams. I learned it where I was at in the Army, and it's constant process. It just never ends.
That's right. It never ends. And it's what I talked about before. You learn by reflecting on what you did. So when you have leaders get together and they talk about what they did, the decisions they made, when you talk through that decision-making process with others, here's how we did it, here's how this guy did it, you have sort of after-action reports and case examples, and you're like, then you begin to learn from that, internalize those things. So that's what you often see in companies that's not done is they say, you're right, they give you a reading list or they send you to a leadership seminar and it ends. Not where the learning can end. It's something that is lifelong, and the more you practice it and the more feedback you get, the more you learn, the more capable you become.
Yeah.
And it's just not seen that. It's not addressed that way.
And I always tell cops that I was in charge of over the years is, you know, leadership is intrinsic too. I mean, I can't sit here and spend all day trying to send you to leadership courses. You have to want to learn yourself. I mean, go out there and there's so much information out there, good information. You know, you have to motivate yourself. I mean, don't rely on other people to make you a good leader. Do it yourself.
Yes. Going to a seminar or something is not going to cut it. And you have to go after anything yourself and spend a little extra time doing it. And it's time well spent. I mean, that's all the extra learning that goes on. And you do need to pursue it yourself. And then pursue it also in social piece. So you talk about leadership with other people. You know, you and I discuss it. You listen to a podcast on things and you have these conversations where you're able to, like I said before, you know, I go back to learning is a social process. You cannot do it. You can't read 50 books on leadership by yourself, never discuss them with anybody, and then I've got it.
Well, brother, wrapping up. I know we talked a little bit off the air, but I want to ask you again, any books in your future? You got a lot of stuff that you can provide people out there. I know you're giving back right now, but
I'm working on one. So it should be, you know, I'm targeting next summer for the release. It's obviously a little slow going, but I learned more about the whole publication process and all that. So I should have it written within 6 months, and then I got to get it through the Pentagon and come out. And it's going to be about thinking. You know, it'll have SEAL references in there, and we'll base it on these maxims for people to have as like a jumping off point. But it'll be, again, domain agnostic. It can apply to everybody. You can use this in whatever business or, you know, silo that you think you're in, and including just your general life. You know, these things aren't really inseparable. Your work life is not two separate things. Work-life balance, right? No. Work is, it's just life.
Yeah, you're right.
there's life. It's not some seesaw that you can put weights on one end and then it could, no, it's called life. And it'll address a lot of those things. And I want to get to these concepts of, you know, thinking deeper and thinking a little bit different. So that's the goal. Look for it, you know, next year.
Love it. Such good material. David Sears, thank you so much, sir, for being on the show. Where can people find you, Dave?
They can go to dcsears.com, and that'll point you to all my speaking speaking stuff and the crisp thinking pieces. We also have a website for www.thinkingcrisp.com, and they can find me there. They see me on Fox News, and you know, reach out via dcsears.com.
Well, much success to you and your company, sir, and I would love to have you back on when that book comes out, brother.
Yeah, I'm all over it.
All right, David, take care, brother.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.